I'm very happy now to welcome Chris Taylor. He is producer and director of the film Food Fight, which is screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
This film is wonderfully entertaining as well as very informative. It's about the food industry over the last 100 years or so and the rise of the organic movement. And it draws such clear connections between what's happening in Washington, D.C., what's happening in the military-industrial complex, and so on, and what goes into our bodies. Tell us a little bit about the connection between World War II technology and post-World War II farming.
You know, if I was going to start the film from scratch, I would probably retitle it Food and War, because the connection between food and how we grow food and war technology is very, very close. Basically, the technology to make munitions in World War II became the same chemistry that led us to make, or enabled us to make pesticides and fertilizer after World War II. So in the process of growing this incredible industrial capacity to make munitions for the war effort, we were left at the end with, what do we do with this capacity? And what happened was it was monetized in the consumer sector. That often happens. War technology often gets kind of reconfigured for the consumer after the war is over, and that's what happened with our food. This war technology became our food-growing technology.
What are some examples of that? What are some examples of war technology turned toward things like fertilizer and pesticides?
Well, the same companies that were making munitions, that's Dow and Monsanto principally, also started making fertilizer and pesticide and herbicide. Basically, herbicide is nerve gas. So what was used to kill human beings in World War II now is turned to kill weeds, basically. And herbicides in general are the most virulent of all the petrochemicals that we use. They're the most dangerous to human beings. And we're having all sorts of downstream results that are really bad, not only for our land, our animals, but also for humans. Very environmentally damaging. So the same companies that were making these chemicals for war started making them for our agricultural sector after the war, and it's kind of led to a way of growing food that is an industrial process rather than an organic process.
The oil industry also played a role in that with their production of, for example, petroleum-based fertilizers.
That's correct. Oil is in everything we eat. You could say if you took a quarter-pound hamburger from one of the popular fast food chains, you would see that you took it apart, you deconstructed it, you would find about 28 ounces of oil in that hamburger. And partly that's the petroleum that's used to make fertilizer and pesticides, and part of that is the energy for the machinery that grows the corn that is then fed to that animal that becomes our hamburger.
Health problems of pesticides that we don't want to go into in great detail now. That's certainly been done elsewhere. What about petroleum-based fertilizers? Is there anything inherently wrong with them?
Well, the serious environmental impact is actually on the soil. The soil is depleted of its life, everything that's in the soil. You pick up a handful of soil, and it's full of microbes and worms and all sorts of small cellular animals that create a living biosphere in that soil that helps nutrify plants. It helps digest nutrients that go into the plants, and it's a very symbiotic relationship. So anytime you're using petroleum-based fertilizer, you're basically killing all these really helpful, life forms. This is where our flavor and taste in our food comes from these minerals in the soil that are digested by microbes. And when you basically use pesticides and fertilizers for this, you're taking all that flavor-producing potential out of the growing process.
And that's one of the things that your film makes so wonderfully clear, is that when the more agriculture became industrialized, the worse the food tasted. There was masses of it, and it was convenient, but it had no flavor.
The start of the film, really, for me, was, and how I thought about doing the movie in the first place, was my sister-in-law was asking me at Thanksgiving dinner about 5 years ago. She said, how come I can't get a good tomato anymore? And it's true, when you go into a supermarket and you look at this round, red, kind of tennis ball-shaped item, that's a little less bouncy than a tennis ball, but about the same flavor. You really can't get a good tomato, short of going to a farmer's market and finding, you know, a tomato that's been grown locally, and it's been grown to its full maturity. And the whole process of how that happens and what actually happens in industrial, produce growing, you know, is a big, big difference. Basically, that tomato is grown and picked green in the industrial paradigm, and then it's gassed with ethyl chloride to make it turn red and to give it a kind of a stable shelf life so that it's going to be able to ship, you know, the average tomato goes about 1,500 miles from farm to plate. And it's got to stay red for that whole time, and it's got to stay firm. And the process by which that happens is antithetical to tasty tomatoes. The growing life of a tomato needs to go a certain length of time so the sugars mature and gives you that great kind of sweet flavor. There's a reason why tomatoes are fruits. They're not vegetables. They're fruits because of the sugar content. But you would never know that from shopping in a, you know, in your average supermarket, where there's basically no flavor to that tomato. It's just a bunch of water and some cellular structure. It's mostly actually lipid, which is a fat chemical. And salt. That's really what the tomato is now, basically a carrier for, you know, for not for flavor and for nutrition, but for salt and fat.
And for tomato shape.
And shape, exactly. It's, you know, you have to have an ovoid tomato that's red. And
right, right.
By doing that, you basically trick the consumer into, you know, into inducing a memory of when that tomato really tasted good at some point in their childhood. It's kind of like the rosebud, you know, from Citizen Kane, experience. When you shop for that tomato, you're desperately trying to remember one time in your life these tomatoes tasted really good. They really don't anymore, and that's, you know, we really lost that in this generation.
So this film, as I started out saying, is really fun to watch, and one of the things that is so and it's also, ladies and gentlemen, full of things that you don't yet know until you watch the film, which I really appreciate. And one of the things was the connection between protesting the war in Vietnam and the revolution against processed food, which was partially spearheaded by the great Alice Waters. Tell us about that.
Well, the irony of, you know, of this subject, and this is what why I thought I would call the film Food and War if I were starting from scratch, is that those same companies that came out of World War II, again, that's DuPont and Monsanto, basically, were also making chemicals, war chemicals, continued to make war chemicals to throw at our foreign policy victims. In this case, the Vietnamese, Agent Orange and napalm were two chemicals that were used extensively in Vietnam. Of course, we're finding out now, 50 years later, that those farm fields on which we use Agent Orange are still poisoned. And the people who work that soil are dying at earlier ages and dying of, you know, cancer-related diseases that are caused by these war chemicals. The same companies that were producing these war chemicals, as we know, were also manufacturing agrochemicals, petrochemicals. And that these were, as they became kind of, big players in the ag business, they also became targets for the anti-war protesters who were protesting their war technology. And that's You know, that's really where the start of the start of an organized organic food pushback came out of these anti-war protests. And in my film, I talk a lot about Berkeley and in California in general, not because they invented anti-war protesting or organic food, but because the media picked it up there and it became broadcast. Many trends come out of California, and this was another one. And Alice Waters' work, I mean, bridged both of these ideas, the fact that we're protesting these big chemical companies who are poisoning farm fields, and they're also poisoning our agriculture in this country. And those two facts were related, and the dots were put together in Berkeley. And then, of course, Alice went on to develop that even further by starting her restaurant, Chez Panisse. And in that kind of establishment, she really emphasized the political connection between food, between the taste of food and these big companies that she was protesting.
She was one of the people who noticed that the very protesters who were out protesting were then eating this processed food out of vending machines and so on, and said, no, we got to do something else. And in the film, you make the connection, which I didn't realize, between chefs who were leading this movement of serving organic food in their restaurants and the rise of farmers markets. That was really, at least in large part, led by these chefs.
The interesting thing for me is that, in general, social trends are driven by economic realities. You really can't get people to change their behavior unless there's a good economic reason to do it. And so I became interested in the kind of the economic development of the organic food movement. And what happened there was that a lot of restaurant dollars got put into what I call the R&D of organic agriculture. And what I mean by that is that these chefs who are looking for taste, looking for flavor, looking for really great produce, realized that they were not getting it from these big growers and the wholesalers and the big supermarkets, and they went searching for taste literally in their own neighborhoods. And that's what happened in the example in the film is Chez Panisse, where they canvassed the local neighborhoods for people who were growing backyard fruits, backyard lettuces, things that had really great flavor and that were available locally. And by throwing money into that niche of the food chain, it developed a really viable small farmer local market that enabled the rise of farmers markets to happen. As we said in the film, there were less than 100 farmers markets nationwide in the mid 70s, and by 2005 there are the last time that I counted for the film, There are 5,000 farmers markets nationwide. So we've gone from under 100 to 5,000 in less than a generation, and that's a really big, I think, testament to what happened in California. And again, this idea that this economic, the dollars driving this revolution, we're coming for in a large part from restaurants.
We're talking to Chris Taylor about the film Food Fight, which is screening in the Santa Fe Film Festival. I mean, speaking of economics, there's another extremely important point, which is the apparently direct connection between the reduction in the price of food caused by industrial agriculture and food production, but the increase at the same time in healthcare costs. You eat junk, you get sick.
Well, the demographics of industrial food are really eye-opening in not a good way. And the clever bit of marketing that's happened for big agriculture and big growers and big food processors is that they've been very successful in using tax dollars to make their costs cheaper, which is a great benefit for them. It's not a great benefit for us because we're paying for that in through our tax dollars into direct subsidies through the farm bill to these big growers. And that's a lot more complicated than I just said, and I explain that in the film as succinctly and I hope entertainingly as possible. But the second part of that is that the big food processors have also been successful in teasing out the real costs, the downstream costs of this cheap, low-quality food supply that they've created. So you have a situation that basically is a supermarket is a store that sells two things. It sells corn and soy. 90% of the calories in the supermarket are iterations of those two, those two plants. And they've done it so cheaply and yet with so little regard to what the health care ramifications are that we're finding out that we're paying for this cheap, we're paying the cost for this cheap food supply 20 or 30 years later when we have chronic food-related diseases like high cholesterol, diabetes, adult-onset diabetes. Is basically, it's a brand-new disease that's arisen in the last 25 years. It was really not even on the radar until recently, and now we're seeing it almost taking off into epidemic-type numbers. But the consumer is fooled into thinking that this food's really cheap, but in fact, the price is are being paid in lifespan and dollars later in life, when you can probably least afford it.
And, I mean, if you think about eating good food, which unfortunately still is quite a bit more expensive than the equivalent unhealthy food that you buy, mass-produced food, if you think about that as an investment in your health, as almost a kind of health insurance, the numbers start looking different.
Well, that's a really good way of putting it, and I think that you've just predicted what I see as the future, and that is that healthcare companies are going to start getting interested in what food their patients are eating. And it makes sense because the single biggest affordable change in healthcare is preventive lifestyle choices, and that means eating healthily. And as the Kaiser Permanentes and the Blue Crosses and these big healthcare providers realize that they're going to be able to pay less premiums to their customers over the length of their lives if they can encourage those customers to eat fresh local produce that's grown organically, then they're going to be putting pressure on those customers to do that. And they're also going to be putting pressure on these big food processors to take the sugar, the fat, the high fructose corn syrup out of their products. We're already seeing it with trans fats. You're seeing labeling for trans fats, and you're seeing a parallel situation with what we saw in tobacco in the 60s, where, the tobacco companies fought the labeling, just as the big food companies are fighting labeling for bovine growth hormones and other kinds of substances that consumers don't want in their food and want to know if it is in their food. They're fighting labeling just as the tobacco companies were in the 60s, and the tobacco companies fought the science. We're seeing the same thing with the big food processors. They're fighting the science. They're putting up their own, they're paying for their own research in most universities to produce results that are favorable to them. But eventually, I think the science is going to catch up, and we're going to find out that not only are trans fats incredibly harmful, but so is high fructose corn syrup. And that's probably just the start. I mean, science is going to catch them eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later.
There's much more we could talk about in the film. The things that are going on in the public schools, the difference between poor versus middle class neighborhoods and what food is available, and I highly encourage people to go see the film. What changes, if any, do you see happening at a national level? There are some Congress people who are working on this issue.
We are beginning to see a large ocean liner starting to turn in the middle of the ocean, and that's kind of the way the Congress is with the Farm Bill and food policy in general. Certainly, the wind is behind our is with us now, and with the Obamas and the White House Garden and Kathleen Merrigan, the number two Secretary of Department of Agriculture. She's a lifelong promoter of organic agriculture, and while Tom Vilsack is not the perfect choice for many of the people who are most progressive about food, he's certainly a step in the right direction from what we've had in the past. We're beginning to see changes, and I think we'll continue to see changes in the way the agriculture committees are populated in Congress. I think we're going to start seeing more progressive food members of those committees and less of the old boy kind of rural state, farm state politicians who are really getting paid by the big growers in their districts not to change the system in favor of the consumer. The other thing that's happening, this is happening today, literally, the Department of Justice is announcing an investigation into aggregation of food processors and aggregation in the food industry. And this is a huge initiative in the sense that they're looking at Monsanto for monopolistic behavior. For my money, that would be the tip of the iceberg for Monsanto, because you could really get into them for some serious antitrust investigations. So the fact that the administration is starting to look at these companies not as allies, but as possible adversaries to the consumer is a very big change, and it's very welcome. I think we need that kind of accountability and that kind of oversight from our government, which has been sadly lacking up to this date.
Chris Taylor is producer and director of the film Food Fight, which screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival this Thursday at 6 o'clock at the DeVargas II Cinema, and Friday at 10:15 in the morning at the New Mexico History Museum. It's one of my picks of the festival. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.